Welcome to Cogitations, a show where each week your host, anthropologist and UC Davis faculty Tarek El-Haik, encounters and talks with fellow thinkers, composers, philosophers, visual artists, filmmakers, and media scholars who cogitate with images, concepts, and forms. These cogitations are more than reflections. They are an expression of a way of life, an antidote to our dimmed access to the infinite, and an invitation to a joyful experience of our finitude. The show takes its name from a concept that has been key in both the philosophical work of the 12th century polymath Averroes and the interplanetary music of composer Sun Ra. Cogitations sound like the enchanting voices, songs, and music of birds of flames that have entered into our dark world. So it is my great pleasure to welcome today Anthony Stavrianakis to Radio Cogitations. And we will be discussing his remarkable book, Living, A Narrative of Assisted Suicide, which was published with the University of California Press last year. But before we welcome Anthony, I would like to just say a few words about what he does, what he's been doing, what his publications are. Anthony Stavrianakis is an anthropologist and CNRS researcher at the Laboratoire d'Ethnologie et de Sociologie Comparative in the University of Nanterre in Paris, France. He has co-authored several books with Paul Rabineau, including Demands of the Day, Designs on the Contemporary, Anthropological Tests, Inquiry After Modernism, and more recently, a short essay, From Chaos to Solace. And for those of you who are interested in these publications, and in particular, the later publications from Inquiry After Modernism to From Chaos to Solace, you are welcome to consult the Anthropology of the Image Lab Intercession page, where there is a link to these publications. So it is my great pleasure to welcome you, Anthony.
Good. Thank you, Tarek. Thank you for the warm welcome.
So there are different ways of entering into this interesting book. And there are three points of entry that I have in mind. And before we get to that, let's just begin with the title. So when we pick up a book written by an anthropologist, we usually get a geographical referent and a methodological referent. And often books written by anthropologists are announce in the title these reference. So we have an ethnography of in country or region X. Okay. When we look at your book cover, we have Leaving and a subtitle that indicates a narrative of assisted suicide. Once we start reading the book, we get a sense that this is a book about voluntary assisted dying in Switzerland, which is something that we learn when we read the back cover and then when we start reading the book. If you would like to start with saying a few words about the way you present the book for the reader through the title, and then we can move to other registers in the book.
It is funny that you mentioned that, because originally one of the first presses that I sent it to, it actually had Switzerland in the title. And I think if I'm not mistaken, it was Stanford. And the acquisitions person there wrote back very quickly within about 6 minutes and said, a book about Switzerland is just of no interest to an American market. So I thought, oh, okay, I know what the next step is. Take Switzerland out of the title, then I might have a chance of somebody being at least willing to take the next step and look at the back cover, maybe look at the first page, second page, maybe we might get some motion. if this anthropological tick of area studies can be bracketed for a moment. And I think I was even before having, you know, had that first sort of reaction, let's call it a reaction to the title, to the book. I was in two minds about whether or not to specify that it takes place in Switzerland already from the get-go, from the title, because on the one hand, as the first part of the book, there is something that is very, very specific to Switzerland that allows this practice to take place in this way, on the one hand. On the other hand, I'm not an anthropologist of Switzerland. I have no area, even something, usually people who work somewhere northern or western typically, you know, make use of expressions like Euro-American or something, by which they probably mean something like the G7 or the G8, depending on whether or not Russia is invited or not. So that sort of cultural reference, you know, I was actually quite pleased to have been able to get rid of. On the one hand. On the other hand, it's the reason I start with part one and specifying what is the parameters, the contours of this parazone, which is which has a Swiss specificity. I mean, it's not for nothing that, you know, they have the banking laws that they have. It's not for nothing that they have the 20th century history that they have, their relationship to Nazism, their relationship to a whole array of juridical, moral, political questions where they like nuance. I'm not trying to make a sort of an overarching or global claim about Swiss political life or Swiss cultural life, but nevertheless, the grey zone doesn't shock them. In a way that, for example, in France, despite the fact that no doubt there are grey zones, at least discursively and ethically, there is a very, very distinct and different posture here.
So now let's again specify certain terms, which you've been elaborating over the past 10 years in your collaborations with Paul Rabineau, and I would like to just perhaps draw our audience's attention to the term inquiry that is also present in the title. And I think it would be very useful for us to get a sense of how you understand this term, how you derive it or reconfigure it from the work of John Dewey in particular, and what is it to give narrative form to an inquiry? I mean, let's talk a little bit about this particular way in contrast perhaps to questions that we have been talking about in the aftermath of the so-called writing culture movement, for example, in anthropology. In other words, my question is, how are you deploying the terms inquiry and narrative and relate them to one another in such a way that you are not only expanding the experimental moment in the human sciences with a keen understanding of the modernist legacy of the human sciences in particular, to which I will return to shortly. But let's talk a little bit about what does narrative and inquiry as terms do in your work, collaborative and single authored, and how their relation is given form in your work.
Sure, no, that's a great question. So again, interestingly, the original subtitle was slightly different. The original subtitle was A Casuistry of Assisted Suicide. So part two, the title of part two is Leaving a Casuistry, to which the response from UC Press was, we don't want people to have to go and look up a word in a dictionary in order to get past the first page. And so I did a straw poll of three family members, and all of them had to go and look in a dictionary. And so I said, okay, fair play. I'm willing, that's sort of the one thing I was willing to sort of, as it were, give up on. It wasn't a red line for me. In a way that, just to say it, I was very, very fortunate with the whole editorial process. Kate Marshall at UC was wonderful, was really, really very welcoming and just a terrific editor, in part because she got the project straight away and she made some suggestions, you know, which I listened to, but there was no sort of pressure to change the work. It could live its life, which I'm very, very grateful for. But the subtitle, yeah, the suggestion was that word should be changed, to which then I accepted that. And then the struggle was to find a word which would do justice to actually what the form of the book was trying to do. And so I think it's interesting, I mean, you're absolutely right, that the term narrative was a response to the question of, well, what form did the inquiry take? And as you absolutely, you know, rightly pointed out, the word inquiry was a term that I took on, you know, thanks to and in sort of learning from Paul Rabinow. In this case, you know, given the kind of fieldwork that I'd ended up doing, which involved a series, and I think the word is important, a series, one after another, of different kinds of proximity towards and in relation to protagonists who were trying to make the step towards ending their life. The term that came to the right term for me was casuistry, in the sense of, how is it that the anthropologist, as the person who is following each of these other people step by step, how is he not going to either singularize each particular case such that they're clothed in the limits of their life or their biography or whatever it might be, such that you would have a set of portraits, which would be nothing more than a collection of portraits, or then the sociological move to sort of raise up a level of abstraction or generality, such that you would have an overarching, whatever it might be, explanation or understanding or variables or a typology of dispositions or whatever it might be that you would then use as a grid or grill to put over those portraits in those individual lives. And casuistry is the right term, because precisely the question was how I, as the one who was putting these experiences, including my own experience in relation to those experiences, into a sequence, how they actually formed, as it were, if not a whole, at least some kind of formed series, which has a beginning and an end. There's a temporality to it. And I'd like just to underscore that, the fact that the sequence in part two is, it's not an after effect of the writing, it's chronological. From Peter to Florian marked the motion from the beginning to the end of the inquiry. And it's really important to sort of take that seriously, I think, because it's it sort of shows, I think it shows my movement as inquirer through the movement space of the inquiry and the scene of inquiry that I had established within Switzerland. Switzerland on the one hand as a specific place where this is happening, and then the conceptual space, a term that Paul and I have taken from Hans Blumenberg, the Bewegungsraum, the movement space. In his case, it's of history, but the question of what kind of conceptual movement space that could take up at the same time Switzerland as a specific historical, social, political site, and then the vector, as it were, of the human sciences as a conceptual repertoire in relation to which, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what you call yourself, anthropologist, sociologist, someone from the human sciences, against which you're obligatorily, you're necessarily going to have to confront this repertoire of terms, especially if you're dealing with something, as as intimately tied to the history of the human sciences as suicide, the social fact. And then also, I think, you know, maybe just the last point on that, on the subtitle, that it is, I mean, in terms of the options, you know, the rhetorical options are demonstration, argument, exemplification, but it wasn't any of those. I'm not making an argument. I'm not performing a demonstration. You know, I think much to perhaps to, you know, a certain version of a sociologist's chagrin. It's a narrative in the sense that I tried to tell a story about my experience. I mean, it's almost sort of a without wanting to over-egg it or to sort of hypostatize it, sort of an element of a sort of phenomenology, a sort of how it was step by step, not coming to consciousness, but an awareness of my proximity to this object, this thing that I, at least I thought I wanted to know, that I wanted to touch and to be touched by. And there's a high point in the case with Clément, and then there's a denouement. There's the limit, the fall, when it breaks the ethical and the scientific limit. And I wanted to tell that story as well. That's part of the narrative about the limits of anthropology, about what one is or isn't willing to accept as part of an inquiry. The question of your desire as an inquirer, how far are you willing to go or not, and why not? And I think, you know, what I've tried to show in the sequence of narratives and then of the lives, you know, that I came into contact with, the place that I was able to occupy or was given in relation, or was asked to occupy or then refused to occupy, in relation to their own search to find an end, to find a way out of what they considered to be their suffering.
I would like to just read from page 5, just to go over again the question of casuistry, which I think is remarkably well formulated on page 5 at the bottom. Casuistry, understood as case-based reasoning, is perhaps best known in its guise within Jesuit moral theology. It would be excessive, and here I assume that you are using Aristotelian language to articulate the way you pin down the term casuistry, right? So a relationship of excess, mean and deficiency, right? So it would be excessive as a mode of inquiry for anthropology if the theological model were taken for anthropology to fix guiding principles that could tell the inquirer how to move from case to case. Similarly, casuistry is deficient when the case becomes an end in itself. Singularity becomes the goal and not the parameter through which enrichment of other cases can be taken up and related. The challenge of an anthropological casuistry in this book is to track the motion from case to case. The term case in my use here, refers to a narrative form given to my effort to occupy a position within a movement space of inquiry and to give a form to, and to the degree possible to seize through understanding or sensibility, or both, the request for an assisted suicide by an individual in relation to other. So this takes us, I think, to, let's call it the subject matter of the book, which is assisted suicide within the modes of jurisdiction and the legal framework of that particular domain of practice in Switzerland. Okay, so it would be, I think, for empirical reasons to give us a little bit of background in terms of the relationship between the mode of subjectivation and the modes of jurisdiction that you see at work in the way you've organized your case studies in sequence, and in relationship to this entity, this national entity we call Switzerland, beyond questions of ethnos or the cultural. So if you could just tell us a little bit about what is the inquiry, what are the breakdowns that you saw at work in the context of Switzerland?
The passage that you read made me think of something that I think is very important that I want to underscore, which is, I wrote it in the book and I meant it 100%, and that's why I want to sort of underscore it now, that it really was for me both the inquiry and then the writing was a test case of a repertoire that I had developed with Paul Rabinow over the last decade. So the trilogy of books that we wrote, the Logic of Inquiry trilogy, Demands of the Day, Designs of the Contemporary, and then Inquiry After Modernism, in a certain way accompanied the fieldwork and then the writing for of this Switzerland book. If I'm not mistaken, so Demands was 2013, that's when it was published, and that was when I started the fieldwork in Switzerland. Designs was 2014, and then Inquiry After Modernism was 2019. And so it really, there was these sort of parallel efforts which were intimately connected and in dialogue with one another. And the passage that you read, and that's sort of the number of hours we spent in Berkeley with the group of us, with Paul, a theologian, anthropologist, Damon Bennett, and others, talking about casuistry, what is a case in anthropology, what sort of the available options were, which seemed somehow dissatisfying. And in a certain way, I mean, and this is where, you know, it's certainly not, you know, trumpet tooting, but just I think I managed to actually do it in the sense of that there was sort of, as it were, a definition we had of, okay, what would it look like to do casuistry in anthropology? And I think that this, as it were, the narrative form was actually, it was very simple. It came to mind very easily because it stemmed from a conviction that a different way of writing case histories was possible, one in which the subject position of the anthropologist was in question and present in the writing and in the case. I wouldn't want to again sort of push it too far. I think that there are other examples, and one that comes to mind is Todd Meyer's book, The Clinic and Elsewhere, which is a really interesting set of reflections on these youth, adolescents who are in a recovery program, a treatment clinic that he follows in the day-to-day outside of the clinic, hence the clinic and elsewhere. And it's really interesting how he configures these sets of sort of open series of these five or six or seven adolescents. And you sort of see how in the way he configures the stories narratively, and he doesn't talk about it in terms of casuistry, but I think that something like that would have been possible with the kind of inquiry that he did, which probably would have then put an accent more on his own position in relation to those adolescents, But I think there's a rich vein to be tapped there in terms of thinking about what the possibilities for casuistic anthropology are. And so then to the actual question you asked me, for me it stemmed from having spent a year during my PhD work, during my thesis in Basel, and just having come across the way that there was a case that had caused some consternation within the city, and the local paper was writing about it. And sort of there was the usual kinds of bioethics talk. And it, at the time, I thought that for an anthropologist who is interested in ethics, which is what I thought I, at least at the time, what I thought I was, I thought just very basic, like really just very simply, I was like, it's curious that no one has studied this ethnographically, or however you want to call it. Just, you know, an inquiry in which, number one, you go and talk to people who are actually doing the thing, and you go and listen to how they're doing it, why they're doing it, and sort of why they're, you know, doing it this way rather than another way. And at the time, sort of, I was aware of the fact that it occupied this sort of quite specific gray zone, this parazone where it wasn't quite legal, but it wasn't illegal. It was different to Belgium and Luxembourg. There wasn't really a legal framing. And I thought that was an indicator to me that I'm on the right path. This is the right site for me. Number one, because I was actually interested in Switzerland. I still am. I think it's a laboratory. It's a European laboratory. They're practical, experimental people, and it's an intriguing place. And so that pointed me in the direction that I wasn't going to become some kind of specialist about euthanasia or death and dying or something. This was a question of ethics on a very serious topic in which the stakes couldn't be higher. And that was the thing that intrigued me about it. Now, initially, I think I do say this in the book, initially I had thought it was going to be the kind of project which frankly sort of bracketed psychology. I thought it was going to be about the judgment, mainly about the judgment of the doctors. I thought it was going to be much more medical anthropology. And just very quickly on spending time with people and talking to them and being around the practice, I realized that actually that is not the problem. It was of no interest whatsoever to anyone. They always say yes. And why do they always say yes? Because the people only ask when there's a serious request. It's extremely rare for someone to ask and not have a serious request. I mean, it can happen. I'm not going to say it never happens, but the vast majority of the time, people who ask have a demand. And these groups, these associations, and the doctors that are working with them and in them are willing to reply to the demand. And for me, that question of why they were willing to reply to the demand wasn't something I wanted to touch on, because what was for me the most important thing was, what is the truth of that desire for the person who's making the request? And that very quickly became a way for me of, as it were, a sign of whether or not there could be any, you know, what I suppose what we typically call rapport, or this, if there could be work going on between myself and the you know, because there weren't only five people that I worked with over the, you know, however many years it was I was in Switzerland, 5-6 years. There were many, many, many people of whom in the end I wrote about those five. Because there had to be some willingness to talk to me about that. Otherwise, I had a desire to know their desire. That's what I wanted. That was what I was fascinated by. I wanted to know, and I wanted them to talk to me about it. because I thought that that would be a way to know something more than what is obvious. I mean, that's why the original title for the piece on Peter, I published it before publishing the book, was called Thinking the Obvious. He had a very, I never met Peter. It was done through archival work, through the film that he made with the BBC and through discussions with his wife. And he had a very sort of English utilitarian, as it were, sort of rationalist, or rationalized, probably a better way of putting it, understanding of what he was up to. And yet, as soon as you start digging, all these other aspects to his demand appeared.
It's to this digging that I want to spend some time on, if you don't mind. And I what I really find very interesting about the book and the way you set up the inquiry, the way you get caught in an assemblage of elements that is coming from the relationship between truth and desire of your interlocutors, and the way you try to listen to their demands, there are two things that I find really incredible. The first is that you set out, right, to use a common trope, you know, anthropological trope, to do something that is, you know, that resembles some kind of medical anthropological approach, right? And then you end up with dealing with the desire of your interlocutors and the relationship between truth and desire, and the and you historicize, perhaps that's not the word that you would use, but you certainly render visible to us the contingency of the relationship between subject, desire, and truth. So it's neither medical anthropology, but it's not psychoanalytical anthropology either. Yet you seem to be surprised that psychoanalysis begins to occupy, you know, quite some room in the book, at least in a portion of the book, the portion that's marked as narcissism and desire and narcissism.
Yeah.
But, and then there's the question of images, to which we will get to in a second. So I'm interested in this, you know, I guess Adam Phillips would call these side effects, right? Mm. You set out to do this and then somehow you are detoured into something else.
Yeah.
And the detour happens not only through the obvious, as you mention it, in the sense that the demands are polymorphous to a certain extent. The demands are vary from case to case, from sequence to sequence. And ultimately you zoom in on a term that you have been working on for quite some time, which is the term ethos, right? Yeah. And the term ethos is explored, and again, perhaps it would be great if you told us a little bit about what you mean by parazone. It seems to me that your inquiry or the space of your inquiry is located in a parazone in which you reconfigure the modernist legacy of the human sciences through zooming in on the concept of ethos, right? And on the other hand, we have this reconfiguration of the conceptual repertoire of anthropology and the human sciences. And you engage three, what you call knowledge domains, namely psychoanalysis, sociology, mainly Durkheimian sociology, and then anthropology. And there is the appearance of that intriguing figure of Gregory Bateson, whom you take distance from in his understanding of the word ethos. So let's walk, you know, the listener, you know, through some of this.
Maybe the first thing to say about that is, sort of, I suppose, unlike the part two, part three is not presented in chronological order, as it were. Durkheim comes first in the inquiry. And what I mean by that is, very early on in doing the inquiry, friends and others sort of basically said, it was the Durkheim challenge. Isn't this anomie, isn't this egoism, isn't it sort of trying to fit it into the model?
To account for the demands of your interlocutors who are seeking to end their life.
Yeah, isn't this egoism? Yeah. Isn't this very simply egoism? No one actually gave that argument. They're remaining on the egoism side. And it was my friend, Gilda Salmon, who told me, actually, there's someone who has something for you who would be interesting to discuss with this philosopher called Bruno Carsanti. And Bruno had had a paper which he hadn't yet published, which he very kindly shared with me, in which, and Bruno is a specialist, he's a philosopher of the human sciences, a specialist of Marcel Mauss and of Durkheim. He knows the oeuvre inside and out, and he's a very imaginative and creative thinker. And Bruno has a reading, or had a reading, which he shared with me, of Le Suicide, suicide, Durkheim's work, as a book of ethics. And it's a very elegant demonstration. And what struck me was, for those of you who made it to that part of the book, what struck me was the three options didn't fit. And as long as I've been working with Paul, and as long as I've known Paul Rabanow, the central object of preoccupation has been ethos. So ethos, both as on the object side, that which one inquires into, and then on the inquirer's side, that there is an ethos of inquiry. Paul is a Weberian through and through. And the question, but then a Weberian of a certain kind. Yes, science, but then what is the form of life for the inquirer? And it was in the context of those discussions, and then within Paul's work, that he had been thinking for a long time, and then especially in relation to the years of work that he had been doing in and with the biosciences. And I had worked with him on that topic as well. That was what my PhD was about. The question of, as it were, the recalcitrance or the obstination on the inquirer's side, to insist on, for example, in this case with the biosciences, it was to insist on questions of ethics in an environment, in a milieu in which instrumental rationality reigned, for example. We'd had discussions, and he published on this term, restive recalcitrance, a term which he had developed with, if I'm not mistaken, with Gaiman Bennett. And it was very intriguing to me. And it was as it were, a conjuncture of these two threads, Bruno's reading of Durkheim as a book of ethics, and Paul's observation, which was then sort of sustained and specified by other readings like Kluge and Necht's History and Obstinacy, Geschichte und Eigensinn, sort of gave me the sense that there's something in this idea of there being a fourth virtue, and a fourth virtue that the moderns, as it were, Durkheim as modern, threshold of the 20th century. It was a virtue term, obstinacy, that he was blind to. And that's what, for me, that was, again, sort of the, as it were, the to come back to your sense of the parazone, or what I would be the movement space, the Bewegungsraum, the movement space of the inquiry, was, again, a test case of the anthropology of the contemporary. I mean, Paul published it in, 2007, 2008, Marking Time, modernity as already becoming historical. I mean, it's terrific. I mean, it's one of these, you know, rare moments, these meditative devices, which are very powerful when you take them seriously and you take them to the letter, and then you can do things with them. So, okay, if modernity has become historical, then what was that history? What have we lost? Where are we? And then what's the next step? And for me, that was the challenge of taking up, okay, the different human sciences have taken up this term ethos in different ways. I mean, almost sort of definitionally, like with Durkheim, Bruno's reading of Le Suicide helped me to see four virtues, so ethos in four modalities, as it were. I mean, he even uses the term in Le Suicide, ethos. Freud, he talks about ethos and character as it's beautiful, the precipitate of lost objects. And then all of the work that's been done in the anthropology of ethics over the last 10, 15 years. So my sense was that even just semantically, I had a coherent field of play, as it were. And then the challenge became at each step, well, what can we learn from these exercises in thinking? And then what are the limits to them? And that's, as it were, that's the, a friend called it a perverse game, to the degree that, you know, it's not what you usually expect from, as it were, a theoretical engagement. Usually you have a theory and then you try and find an example to show the power of the theory, or you exemplify the theory. But this is the opposite game. It's to show the limit of the theoretical apparatus. And that to me is also about, as it were, in that sense, character, the precipitate of lost objects. You learn something, but you lose something because you keep going. The theory doesn't have the answer. It just helps you to ask a question in a different way. And I think for me, that was part of the motion through that sort of conceptual space at the end of the book. Narcissism is not egoism. To ask this question of the truth of desire, it's to have an answer, egoism, it would be completely inappropriate and be foolish, even. Selfish, individualism, something like, you know, modern individualism, the liberal subject. I mean, you know, something like that, of that sort. It tells you nothing. Now, that's not to say that narcissism by itself as a term doesn't give you an answer, but at least it puts you on the path.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the track to ask about, illness, the body, the image, what is the image world, the imaginary of this person in their narrative? What are they able to share with me? What is the assemblage, the agencement of people and things that have sustained and constituted this desire? The ethics of the narcissism, which, you know, there's an external view and an internal view. The external view is obstination. That was the term I settled on, obstinacy. Obstinacy as the ethical response viewed from the outside to that narcissism within that desire. And then from the internal view, because, you know, I'm an anthropologist, I spent time with these people, I was there, being there, it's supposed to be important to us, right? I mean, that in itself, that also is, you know, I'm glad I had the occasion to, this is also a way of me being grateful. This is a way of recognition and gratitude for very important moments during the past 10 years. I remember at the beginning of the project, I was in Paul's office, and I was telling him about, you know, this idea for this project. And I mean, just in his usual way, he just sort of came out with it and said, well, you know, are you planning on being present at a suicide? And this was to 2012, something like that. It had been years since I'd been to Switzerland. I knew nothing about this. And my first response was completely clear. Oh, no, you know, absolutely not. Like, why would I need to do that? Like, that's not the important part. The important part is everything that happens before and after. Which, interestingly, was precisely what Clément said to me sort of during our exchanges. Fetishization of the act. Yeah, maybe, but it's also really important to be there. And so then the internal ethical question was to capture the ethics of that narcissistic desire, what position could I occupy? And that's where, you know, again, you know, it's, and I think you can hear the the way of narrating this project and the way of narrating how this thinking has operated, the sort of the importance that Paul has played in it. It was in discussion with him that he said to me, talking about this question of the internal position and what position I was occupying to capture the ethics of that narcissism. He said, you know, what I remember very vividly, a conversation we had, what you're saying to me makes me think of the Barthes and Le Neutre. And he had heard. And this is the other part of it as well. It's also about the ethics of friendship and the ethics of collaborative inquiry and the ethics of shared motion within the movement space of inquiry and thinking together, talking together. He had heard very, very clearly what I was trying to tell him, and he responded. And that it was, and I think that's also why the book ends on that. It ends there rather than how it could have ended or how I could have been pushed by others to end it.
Which might have been what?
Which might have been very clearly. I mean, in relation to your question about the parazone, it might have been, okay, well, what about the legislator? What about politics? Is it good or is it bad? Should we have a law? Should there be a law? Shouldn't there be a law? What about euthanasia? To which my response is, I have nothing to say about that. It's not my position. It wasn't the position I occupied. I'm not a legislator. I'm not the law. All I was concerned about was to attempt to grasp the movement of that desire. And to show my hope would be, perhaps it's misplaced, but my hope would be that, you know, a reader of the book acknowledges that I don't come out clean from this book. Morally compromised narrator. And it's appropriate. You take a position and you have to take responsibility for it.
But the question that I want to ask is, are you put in a position of a witness or one participant observer among other participant observers, which is something that I really love about your book, is that you are not the only participant observer.
Yeah.
So participant observer is no longer marked as an anthropological method. Yeah. But would you help us think about what is the distinction between a witness and an observer in that particular situation?
I was asked to be a witness on several occasions.
Okay.
And, you know, I like the fact that I can, you know, write my family into the book. The dinner scene, which is an important turning point in the narrative, mm-hmm. where I come back from this meeting in Strasbourg and Laurence Tessier, my wife, a wonderful anthropologist, who has just published a piece in L'Homme about COVID ICU work, a very, very powerful piece. We're at the dinner table and I'm explaining what happened in Strasbourg, where this person has asked me to stand in for her daughter. This is relatively early on in the inquiry, to which, in her usual way, frank way, said, "What are you doing? You can't do that." And that was what I was being asked to do, was to witness, both to facilitate and to witness. And also in sort of almost a juridical sense, to witness, in the sense that the police need a witness, somebody who quote unquote knows the person. Or Florian. And there was, witness more in, I don't know exactly, what the term means or sort of what the multiple significations that the term can have, but, something like the Christian witness, which I can only imagine has, some register of love and sacrifice in it. That was what he was asking me for. Love me. And I couldn't. I didn't want that.
That's the Pontalis definition of desire, right? I don't have the page in front of me, but the distinction between need and demand, right? And Pontalis argued that to listen to one's demand is to basically, it's a request for love, ultimately. That's what you are saying now, right?
That is what I'm saying. Okay. And that the question of desire is distinct from the question, so there's need, there's demand, and there's desire. And they're not the same. No one needs an assisted suicide. You can't need an assisted suicide. You can demand an assisted suicide, and you can desire an assisted suicide. You can demand that someone is there, and that person can either respond through their desire or not. And in this is a long way of responding to your question, which is the central one, which is what is the position of the participant observer? And in the, as it were, the solution to that problem that I found was the second order participant observer. There had to be someone in that second position such that I could observe their observation. Now, that didn't mean I was outside. That's the whole point of the long exegesis on Fabian's work and the composite subject complexity. And the way, and I stand by that. I really do think that that's what was happening, was that there was some kind of compositeness to the subject position that I was able to occupy, but which didn't mean being engulfed by it, which wasn't totalizing. There was room for motion in and out with Clément, which there wasn't with Florian. There was no room to be that other kind of participant observer, second order.
There are the criticism that you level of the conceptual, apparatus of psychoanalysis, but it seems to me that the relationship between psychoanalysis and anthropology in the book is not one that you would call psychoanalytical anthropology, but nonetheless, the parazone between these two knowledge domains suggests to me that perhaps desire could be understood as an assemblage of heterogeneous elements that includes images, for example, right?
Yeah.
That provide the matter, this is in my own words, that provide the matter with which the subject carries out his or her ethical work. Is this?
I'd say I came out of this project as a Deleuze-Guattarian, somewhat surprisingly. It was not something expected, but. And in the same way that Anti-Oedipus is not an anti-Lacanian text. It's a very close reading and very proximate engagement. I think that the difficult thing for me on finishing this book was straight away I started, I mean, I was doing the, you know, finishing part of it, the, you know, editorial things, while I had already started a new fieldwork project on ALS, living and dying with ALS. So I was based in a clinic in the US, a clinic in California. And I'd picked California because since 2017, as I'm sure you all know, assisted suicide is possible in California, the End of Life Options Act. It's called medical aid in dying, but it's the same thing, more or less. And I think the thing which I felt very strongly was a sense that I was somehow not in the right place. I wasn't in my place, in part because that kind of clinical ethnography, where, or you know, however you want to call it, field work in clinic, in which the observer position was intimately tied to a group of professionals or an apparatus or what have you, it didn't give me a position in relation to a subject who wanted to work through things that were of concern to them. And so I think that that's where, you know, I realized that sort of more thought about what kinds of work will permit that kind of position in which I'm able to hear and to work through, and then perhaps eventually to write in relation to another person's capacity to work through their own experiences of suffering, of loss, of what it is that they want.
So Anthony, there is a beautiful passage on page 151 in which I hear Stavrianakis making a form of diagnostics that is in dialogue with the kind of interpretations that psychoanalysts would venture. But there is this moment in which you say, it seemed to me as I began to constitute in my imagination a series of cases and a series of repetitions, that what was being repeated was precisely not memories of past deaths, but rather a form given to images of dying that bear in one way or another on a present desire toward the process of dying. Okay. What I found very interesting in this particular passage is the way you recruit the imagination, the way you recruit and use terms such as passive synthesis, you know, on various occasions you use that term, and the attention to repetition as you listen to the desire of the interlocutor to move towards dying. Okay, you don't have to answer this, but I like that moment where you are trying to think about the diagnostic in relationship to your interlocutors and in the repetitions that you see at work in throughout the sequences.
I think in that's exactly why I needed to write the last part of the book. I wanted to ask myself, why am I doing this? You know, anthropologist, fine, what does that mean? Like, what can we actually learn from any of these human sciences? What can I take with me? What can be part of an actual practice? When you go somewhere, when you go and talk to someone, when you sit there with them, when you're listening to them, you're trying to contain yourself, you're trying to contain the situation, you're trying to contain what you're being given. You're trying to work through the, as you put it, you know, the filter, the images come to mind, they go away, they're selected, not selected, things mark you, they don't mark you. And we're supposed to then objectify that because we write, apparently. And I think, you know, I frankly, you know, I developed a crush on psychoanalysis through the work, in part because it seemed to me an outside to what I felt was the disappointment of the other possible subject positions, the other possible observer positions. Now, you know, no doubt, you know, I think it would be absolutely the biggest, you know, the big mistake is to then somehow transfer the psychoanalytic repertoire into anthropological method. There's counter-transference and transference. It's just they're not the same discourse. I mean, either you're dealing with the unconscious or you're not. And I think that was the very fine line that I had to walk. And I hope I walked it on the right side rather than on another side. The right, in the sense of the correct or less disappointing side of that line, to the degree that what was important for me was to stay at the level of the imaginary, because I didn't have the right, and I didn't want to. The point wasn't the real or the symbolic or the Clément's unconscious or what really happened with Florian and his mother. Now, I allow myself to say something, to, as it were, hypothesize, you know, it's not the right word, but hypothesize, to have a go, to try and say something. But then I immediately take it back. And it's the taking it back which is important. So I don't have the place. I don't have the position to make that kind of an interpretation. Mm-hmm. And so that was the point as well, was to say, there is in what we do as well, qua anthropologists, in our capacity as anthropologists, is also the desire to make interpretations. And this comes back to your friend Bateson. So, okay, so you have a desire to make an interpretation. What is the legitimate interpretation? What's the limit to the interpretation as well? Just up to what point are you willing to sustain it? Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the ethics question.
Anthony, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Tarek, for the invitation. And thank you very much for, you know, for your generous questions. And
we wish you good luck on your endeavors. And
thank you.
We will be in touch soon. Take care.